You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll talk to a UW-Madison professor about tick season and ways we can protect ourselves and our pets.
First, recent tests in Kewaunee County found that around 60% of wells were polluted with fecal microbes. The bacteria contaminating the water has the ability to make people and livestock sick.
And at a recent public meeting with residents and scientists, questions were raised about whether enough is being done to safeguard the water supply in an area where cows greatly outnumber people.
Coburn Dukart joins us now. She covered the news as part of Wisconsin Watch's Failure at the Faucet series. She's the digital and multimedia director for the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Coburn, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, talk us through this study. What were they looking for? What did they find?
Yeah, so these scientists were trying to figure out the source of contamination of private wells in Kewaunee County and try to figure out whether it was more concentrated from bovine sources or human sources. And then they were also looking at how the contamination gets into the wells and how quickly it can move through the wells. So it was a multi-part study that had three different objectives.
And the main thing people on the user end, the people using the water, are worried about is what's in the water and what kind of risk does it put them at? What did we find out?
Well, they found that there was over 30 different pathogens that are in the water at any given time. And I think one of their main findings was that the contamination can move very quickly. The geology of the county is such that the bedrock is very porous and fractured. And so any contaminant that gets in on the surface can very quickly move to the groundwater through the aquifer below. So if you have a contaminated well, the thing that they found that I think was most surprising is that you might do a sample one day and find that your water is clear, and then do a follow-up sample and find that there's contamination.
And what was the source of this for the most part? Did they find out cow or human?
Well, they've decided that it's both cow and human, and the concentration has varied, again, depending on when they're doing the samples. So they found some pathogens at a higher concentration of bovine. And then what their hypothesis is that humans are contributing to the contamination all year round through a very low level contamination through septic leakage, either mostly through septic systems, but that when farms spread manure on their fields, especially during certain times of year, and especially when there's rain or snow melt, that's when the bovine contamination can get into your well.
And what kind of diseases then might people, or calves for that matter, be exposed to?
Yeah, there's a number of pretty dangerous pathogens that are getting into people's water. E. coli is one that a lot of people are familiar with, as well as Salmonella and Cryptosporidium, which people in Wisconsin will be familiar with as the source of the Milwaukee outbreak in 1983. There's also rotavirus A and C, which has popped up, which was surprising to the scientists.
Talking to Coburn Dukart from the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism about recent research into water quality in Kewaunee County, a long-running problem, issues of contamination of water. What is going on with people using their water now? I know at some point people were getting bottled water, people who had contaminated wells. What are we seeing there these days?
Again, it's very dependent on where you live. People need to be aware of the depth of bedrock in the area where they live, but there are a number of sources of clean drinking water that they can get if they find contamination. The DNR is now providing bottled water to people that had contamination. There's also a free water kiosk at one of the local high schools where people can get free water.
But there are people who will not turn on the tap and drink that water.
There are people who will not turn it on and drink that water.
So what kind of things, when they're testing actual water at the tap, I mean, you have a photo on your piece of actual brown water that had come out of a tap, apparently. What are people seeing, the users of the water?
Well, you might not actually see anything, which I think is one of the dangers that people need to be aware of. You could fill up a glass of water from your tap, and it might not smell or have anything that you would see that would alert you to the fact that it's contaminated. And so that's really one of the dangers of the water right now up there.
So if I'm a homeowner there with a well, and I know my water's contaminated, do I have options for treating my water at, you know, the level of my house?
The scientists are recommending a couple of different options. There's reverse osmosis systems, which you can put on one faucet at your home, or you can do a whole house, a reverse osmosis system, which is going to be very expensive and prohibitively expensive for some homeowners. There's also UV light treatment that you can install.
But But it sounds like on an economic level, treating this house by house may not be a viable solution.
That's definitely not going to be viable for most homeowners up there. I heard a report that one homeowner spent $17,000 to install a whole house system. But even for some people, putting a RO system on one faucet would cost too much.
And then the concern you mentioned, there's this unique geology where it's very easy for manure to run off and end up in a water supply. Is there talk of changing the way the land is used, the way manure is spread to try to prevent this contamination in the first place?
There is talk going on. And I spoke to someone from the DNR. They are revising what's called the NR 151 runoff management rules. And those rules should be out later this year, where they're going to put some new restrictions on manure spreading and some voluntary for concentrated animal feeding operations, and also some voluntary rules for smaller farms.
Talk about some of the people doing this research. You covered some of what they had to say. What are they saying to people in Kewaunee County?
They're saying that you should be aware of your well depth, which is one of the things that could be variable, and also the time of year. So in spring and fall, when there's more rain and also snow melt, you should be aware that that could be a time when contamination is more likely to happen in your well water. So I think they're just saying you really should just be careful and be aware of your unique geology, where you live, where your home is.
And on the human side, you quoted Mark Borchardt, one of the researchers, and he's personally, after he gets results, calling people, let him know, I'm sorry, your water, it tested positive for salmonella or cryptosporidium or whatever.
Yeah, Dr. Borchardt is very concerned with public health. And even though he didn't want to release the full results of his data before he had finished with the analysis, if he got a positive result for a dangerous pathogen that could make someone sick, and in some cases, if it's an infant or an elderly person, they could even die, he would call that homeowner right away and say, this is what I found in your water.
Who is at the table in trying to tackle this problem and solve it?
Well, there's so many people. That's one of the reasons it's very contentious up there in Kewaunee. But there's a lot of people. Everyone's very aware of this issue. Everybody's working very hard to solve it. The DNR, DACCAP, the county board, public citizens, scientists. Everybody is looking at this issue, dairy farmers, trying to solve it.
And you wrote that this is a county where cows outnumber people by a pretty good margin.
Yeah, and that's one of the things. There's 20,000 people, but 97,000 cows. And unfortunately, I interviewed one of the researchers, Maureen Muldoon. She said that this county is one of the hydrogeologically worst places to put a lot of cows in our whole state.
But that cow-to-people ratio, I mean, that's not going to change anytime soon, is it? We're not going to see a sudden migration of the dairy or the cattle industry out of Kewaunee County.
Not that I'm aware of, no. There's not going to be a reduction in cows.
So this study came out and there was a public meeting last week. What are the next steps?
Well, the scientists are continuing to do research. They're still doing statistical analysis on the data that they collected. There's some public citizens that are very vocal in just trying to keep this issue on the table. The DNR is working diligently on this. There's a group of farmers, Peninsula Pride, that's bringing the dairy farmers together to see what they can do. There's a lot of different methods that they can use to try and keep the manure from entering both the groundwater and the surface water.
Coburn, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. Thanks for having me.
That's Coburn Dukart, Digital and Multimedia Director for the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, talking about her reporting on contaminated water in Kewaunee County.
As summer approaches, we spend more time outdoors. And as we know, warmer weather brings out the bugs. And this summer looks like it's going to be a big one, especially for ticks. Susan Paskowitz joins us now. She's an expert on ticks and a professor and chair in the Department of Entomology at UW-Madison. Susan, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, how big does the tick population look this year?
So early on, we were seeing ticks out earlier than we normally do. You know, in a normal year, we don't really start picking much up until April and May. And this year, even in February, we were seeing adult deer ticks out. And so that was kind of interesting and obviously related to the very mild, relatively speaking, mild winter that we had. But every year we actually go to a series of different locations. We call them our sentinel locations throughout the state. And we do much more kind of formal sampling so that we can compare what we're seeing this year with what we've seen in past years during the month of June, which tends to be the peak period for transmission of Lyme disease and other tick-borne diseases in our state. And so what I can tell you is that we've been out now to 10 of our sites. We have not yet hit too many that are in the northernmost tier of the state, but 10 of the sites that are, say, from about Stevens Point further south, and those are actually not looking like we're seeing tremendously big numbers of ticks, at least for the deer ticks for this year. And we don't normally look at wood ticks in the same kind of detail. That's the other major tick that people in Wisconsin would get on them when they're hiking. But we're also not really seeing anything striking, I think, about that tick.
And you care about the deer ticks, so these are the little guys, right, first of all?
Yes, that's right. So an adult deer tick, maybe the size of a sesame seed. Right now what we're seeing is the peak of an immature stage called the nymph, and they're more the size of a poppy seed, so really difficult to see if you do get one on your person.
So it's the deer ticks that seem to carry most of the diseases that we worry about, is that right?
That is right. In Wisconsin, there are now vectors of 6 or 7 different things, everything from viruses to a parasite that's a little bit like malaria, and then a number of different bacterial agents, including the one that causes Lyme disease.
So there's another out there that I actually had not heard of until just today, a tick-borne disease that seems to be a little more severe. I'm not sure I'll pronounce it right, but something called Powassan.
Yes, indeed, Powassan virus. And so you're right, it is more severe for people who actually develop symptoms. In Wisconsin, we've had only 25 cases of Powassan virus since people started looking, which I think was about 2003. We had 5 cases last year. So this is a very rare disease. It's not something that's common like Lyme. You know, with Lyme, we estimate that we probably have about 30,000 cases a year, every single year. So quite a difference. So it's rare, you know, but again, unfortunately, there are a number of people who get it. It can be a fatal illness, or it can actually be pretty damaging to the nervous system. So people can have long-lasting impacts of being infected with that virus. We've done a little bit of work looking in some places where we know that this virus has been transmitted to people at what the levels of the virus look like in tick populations, and it's really low. So we've looked at these immature stages, for example, and we've not been able to detect it, and looking at about 100 to 200 samples from different places. When we look at the adult ticks, those numbers go up a little bit. So some places, for example, it might be 1 to 2%, you know, 1 out of 100, 2 out of 100 of the adult deer ticks that might be infected with this Powassan virus.
Are there particular areas of the state that are more closely associated with Powassan?
You know, usually when it's a deer tick associated agent, we do tend to see that the northern part of the state, less in the east, less in the southernmost quarter. And I believe that's true for Powassan as well. I think the reason for that is that when you get down here into the southern part of the state, going up kind of then on the eastern towards Green Bay and Door County, it's a lot more agricultural. So there's less of that kind of wooded habitat that the deer ticks do so well in. You know, if we go out and look in a grassy field, we rarely would find a lot of deer ticks. Maybe we'd get a few along the edge. Once in a while, we'll see them out in the middle of the opening, but that's not common. If in those kinds of places, we expect to see a lot more wood ticks.
Well, I know people may want to know what they need to worry about now. In other words, what are the symptoms of Powassan? This is very rare, again, let's stress that. But if someone should develop symptoms, what should they be looking for?
You know, unfortunately, I don't think they're particularly obvious. A lot of times symptoms of these diseases, you start with fever, you might have headache, you might have muscle aches. I think Powassan is the same. You know, differently there, if it develops into something really nasty, you are going to go see your doctor. You're going to know, because symptoms will be signs of, you know, invasion of your nervous system. So you might have confusion, and you might have a stiff neck, and you might have mobility problems. And so those are the kinds of things that would send you, I think, to the doctor anyway. So they're not really that different from a lot of other infections that you might pick up in the summer. And unfortunately, because it's a virus, there really aren't any medications, I think, yet that have been used against Powassan that are particularly effective.
Entomologist Susan Paskowitz from UW-Madison is with us now to talk about this year's tick season in Wisconsin. And Lyme disease, that's one that more of us are familiar with. I know several people who've been treated for Lyme disease. It seems like there's a lot of awareness around it. But Susan, can you walk us through what we need to look out for when it comes to ticks and Lyme disease?
Sure. So yes, Lyme disease definitely our most abundant tick-borne pathogen, most prevalent. You know, 30,000 people probably every year in the state of Wisconsin who are picking up that disease. And you know, you can protect yourself by trying to stay in those more open areas. If you're hiking in the woods, which everybody ought to do, right? Get out and enjoy our beautiful woods here. It's going to be important in those kinds of environments to take some personal protection. And so I always recommend to people who are just out recreationally that they stay kind of in the middle of the hard pack of the trails and try not to brush up against the vegetation along the sides of the trails, because these ticks are kind of cool this way. They climb up the vegetation and they hang out there waiting to get some kind of stimulus. And once they know that something's moving by, then they'll grab on to whatever brushes up against them. So if you stay in the middle of the hard pack, there aren't going to be deer ticks so abundant there. The other thing you can do is you can treat your shoes with a chemical called permethrin. So you don't want to spray that on your shoes when you're wearing them, or your sandals or something, because you don't want to get it on your skin. But for me and my field team, we do treat our clothing. We're always wearing long pants. We've got socks. We're going to treat those things with this permethrin compound. And once the clothes have dried, they are pretty good at repelling the ticks or at killing any of the ticks that actually walk up your clothing.
I always think of spring as the busiest time for ticks. May in particular, I've gone out for hikes and come back covered, and then seems like later in the summer it tapers off.
Yeah, absolutely. Your observation is dead on. And partly that's because when you're out in that early part, that April, May part, you're seeing those adult ticks, which are a little bit bigger, so they're much easier for you to see when you come back covered or when your dog comes back and has a lot of ticks on the dog. And then we see a second peak in October, but not as many people are out kind of hiking at that time of the year. So the hunters probably will be seeing them then, but you know, the regular population, it's that April, May when they notice it. So then again, unfortunately, just to stress this to people, right now is actually the time when those nymphal ticks, the ones that are the size of the poppy seeds, that's what we think actually makes people sick the most, because you just don't notice them. So you need to be doing very careful tick checks, doing your best to protect your person. You can use repellents. You can use these clothing. And then if none of that works, of course, after you've been out in places where you might have been exposed, you want to watch for symptoms in the summer. And if you get symptoms, get to your doctor, get a prophylactic treatment, or get a treatment of your disease as quickly as possible.
Now, Susan, you use the word tick check. Can you describe for us what a good quality tick check would be?
Yeah. So for me, what I do is I take a shower with a scrubby first when I get back from the field every day, and I try to use one of those back scrubbies, you know, the whole thing. I'm feeling my hair through my hair very carefully. When I get out of the shower, then I look very carefully and very slowly at pretty much every part of my body that I can actually see. Obviously, you know, if a tick gets in the middle of your back and you don't have somebody to help you check that, then you're probably not going to detect it, especially these tiny ticks. But you know, unfortunately, even me with my careful tick checks, I can recall a couple of times where I was done with all my check, and I sat down to call my husband on the phone, and I looked down, and there was a tiny little deer tick walking up my arm. I thought it was a freckle. So you know, even with the level of scrutiny that we give them, and we know the size, you know, we know what to look for, we still have a hard time always finding them.
Yeah, I read an article today suggesting that you ask a friend or a family member to check the parts of you where the sun doesn't shine, because there could be a tick there. Like, it can get into awkward territory. Is it that important that you check every nook and cranny?
It is true. I mean, in general, for me, I find, especially with the adults, that they do tend to like to be, you know, on your head. They often will go up. I don't think that's as true as those nymphal stages. So I found them attached at my knee. I found them on my arm. So they could be any place. A lot of people who get Lyme, though, as a result of tick bite, they do develop this symptomatic rash And so you're actually kind of lucky if you develop this, they call it erythema migrans. If you develop that rash, then it's a no-brainer.
Then you know.
It's really obvious, yeah, that's what you have and you should go get the treatment. And the doctor will recognize that pretty readily.
So what about our pets? Because you mentioned our pets can go outside and bring them back in. What should we do to make sure the pets don't do that?
Well, so, you know, unfortunately, depending on where you are, one of the methods is you just have to sit down with the dog and comb through it as carefully as you can and try to remove all the ticks that you find. A lot of people will treat their animals with something like a Frontline product. That's what I always do to my dog.
Does it work pretty well?
Yeah, it does, actually. Sometimes the dog will bring a tick into the house, but normally those ticks have gotten a little dose of this chemical and it'll kill them. So I might find one, like, dried up or almost dead, you know, something like that. So I do use that to try to keep those and fleas, you know, down on my animals.
So if you do find one of those dead ticks, say, on your dog, does that mean the tick has already bitten your dog and you should see a vet?
Well, you know, again, it probably depends an awful lot on how long that tick was attached. It's much like the human situation. If a tick is on you for 24, 36 hours, less than that, then the likelihood that you're going to get Lyme goes way down. It would be the same for your dog. Mm. So if you had a tick that had been on the dog for less than a day, you're probably okay.
And Susan, as we wrap up, let's say you find a tick on yourself. What's the best way to get it off?
Oh, really good question. We've been trying a number of new things this summer, so we might have to report later after we've actually got some data from our field team. But the way we've done it always in the past is we'll take a pair of tweezers. We take the tweezers and put them as close to where the tick is embedded. It's got little mouth parts that are actually inserted into your skin. And then we do a slow pull backwards because you're really trying to get that tick to release itself rather than pulling it too firmly, in which case you can leave the mouth parts actually inside the body, which you don't want to do.
Well, it's going to be an interesting summer, Susan. Thank you so much for joining us and sharing all this.
No problem.
That was Susan Paskowitz, professor and chair of the Department of Entomology at UW-Madison. And she joined us to talk about this year's tick season in Wisconsin. To learn more, go to wiscontext.org/ticks. As lawmakers continue to tinker with the state budget, regents from the University of Wisconsin system are calling for more money for higher education to help retain talent and repair aging campus buildings.
The UW system has been faced with the loss of some high-profile faculty and staff as some of them leave the state in search of more stability, more competitive pay, and better research facilities.
Karen Herzog joins us now. She's the higher education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Karen, welcome back.
Thank you, Veronica.
Karen, where are we in the budget process right now?
Well, the Joint Finance Committee is the first step of the process for coming to a full budget. The budget still has to go through the rest of the legislature, and that is expected to happen sometime later this month. There are some things that have not been decided yet, even at that level, the Joint Finance Committee level, that is the budget writing level. For capital projects, as you mentioned, the projects that need to be done to facilities at UW system campuses, and also the pay proposal for raises for faculty and staff, that is still something. There have been some signals telegraphed that perhaps there might be some money, but how much is an unknown factor at this point.
How much are regents asking for from the UW for these building repair projects and also raises for staff and faculty?
Well, the building projects, that was a really big ask, and clearly everything that the regents requested, they're not going to get. There's $100 million in what's called all agency funding that's significant and that appears to be looking good at this point. That's for those repairs, for those smaller ticket items that you have some significant things happening on campuses. UWM, for example, has a chemistry building with some safety issues where there's concern that, you know, students aren't even safe in that building with the fume hoods that aren't working correctly. But all in all, I think the governor had suggested a much smaller amount than what the UW system requested, and it has yet to be determined how much will come forward.
And in terms of raises for faculty at the university, what is the ask there?
Well, the ask there is 2% increase each of the next 2 years in the biennium, and that would cost about $78 million. And the UW system traditionally pays 30% of any state pay plan increase, and that would be about $23 million. And they're saying, we want the state to fully fund this, and that we're not talking tuition money involved here. This would be strictly from the employee compensation reserve. They want the state to fund it because they've had a freeze in tuition, which is their other main source of income, and they're saying that, you know, if we have to do all this ourselves, it's going to cost us a lot more, and other state agencies get full funding for state pay plan increases.
And so, in terms of the ongoing story about retention of especially high profile faculty in the university system, what are regions saying about how the UW is doing at keeping faculty on board here?
Well, it varies by campus. UW-Madison has had some high-profile losses, no doubt about it, but they also have resources to try to retain faculty. They have additional money that they can put into research packages to try to retain faculty. They have more resources, although they would tell you that they're very concerned. It's the other campuses, especially the comprehensives, that just can't afford to put more money into faculty salaries to keep them. The faculty turnover the end of last academic year, not the current one, but the last one, ranged from 5.3% at UW-Madison to 13.3% at UW-Superior. And faculty salaries, the peer gap, as other universities around the country have given raises, averaging the cost of inflation 2%, generally speaking, while UW has been flat or there have been really small raises over the last 10 years. But the average pay gap is about 18% behind the peer institutions.
And to be clear, this money requested by the UW Regents for salary increases, it's not to retain faculty who may have a job offer somewhere else to keep them here. It's across the board to lift the salaries of the entire faculty and staff. Is that correct?
Well, not necessarily. Initially, it did sound like that, but it would be across the board. But since then, there have been discussions that what would happen is that pool of money would be given to chancellors at each campus. And then those chancellors would have the discretion to decide who got the raises based on performance. They would have to come up with a way to allocate the money. So it wouldn't be everybody. It would be based on performance. And performance is something we hear a lot about the UW systems. Funding, general funding for its operating budget also will be partially performance-based.
We're talking with Karen Herzog right now, higher education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and she's with us to talk about the UW Regents calling on lawmakers to invest more in the UW system for building repairs and for raises for faculty and staff. And Karen, looking at those building repairs, you mentioned some at the UW campus. Are there others in the system that were highlighted at this Regents meeting?
There are a lot of buildings that are kind of waiting in the queue, and one of the concerns is that things get more expensive the more you put them off. Chemistry building is a high priority for UWM. Some of the campuses are getting money for their residence halls. UWM is getting some money to renovate Sandberg Hall. There's some repair work going on at residence halls in UW-Madison. Platteville had some pretty significant requests as well, wanting to increase their profile in engineering and sciences. There's probably every campus has a project or more, well, several projects. I think there were a total of 29 major projects that were in the initial ask of like $795 million. And then the governor had suggested that he could see fit to fund $128 million of that $794 million.
And Karen, looking at some lingering question marks over the forthcoming UW budget, what is the latest on Governor Walker's request for tuition cuts?
The tuition cut didn't really strike a chord with even Republican lawmakers. There was certainly an interest in holding the line on tuition. tuition, and that is what the Joint Finance Committee voted to do, would be to freeze tuition for the next 2 years. The 5% cut that the governor had recommended did not go through, and I think it's pretty likely that we will see a continued tuition freeze. Tuition has been frozen since 2013, so 4 years, you know, going on to the next 2 years.
And what about the possible impact of possible federal cuts on the university system?
The big concern is research. Non-defense discretionary spending in President Trump's budget was cut $479 billion, It was a $57 billion decrease. While defense spending was going to be increased. So institutional support, research funds like from the National Institutes for Health, National Science Foundation, there's concern about that kind of funding. There's also a concern for students in financial aid. There was a proposal to eliminate subsidized loans. And subsidized loans are loans that the government pays the interest while students are in college, and they don't have to start paying interest on their loans until after they graduate. There's different types of federal loans. That's the most attractive one. It saves you the most money while you're in college. That, if that is eliminated, that would be a huge cost for a lot of students.
And Karen, before we let you go, the atmosphere between lawmakers and university officials and regents, there's been some tension here in this relationship over the last couple of years over the budget and other issues. How has that evolved as we go into this next budget cycle?
It's noticeably gotten better. The previous budget, there was so much tension because there was still the after effects of the mistrust over some cash balances that had been held over by UW system campuses. I think that trust is starting to be rebuilt, and things seem to be going more smoothly this time around.
Karen, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you, Veronica.
Karen Herzog is the higher education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and she joined us today to talk about UW Regents calling on lawmakers to invest more in the UW system to retain talent.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This weekend saw the hottest weather so far this year in south central Wisconsin, with temperatures in the 90s over the last few days.
Winter's known for its winter weather. We have our hot spells as well as the current weather is showing. We want to know, wherever you are in the state, how do you beat the heat? Do you get outside anyway? Do you enjoy the hot weather, or do you try to cower away from it as much as you can? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And always the eternal question, do you prefer a hot summer or a cold winter? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we take our first caller now. We have Greg joining us in Helenville. Greg, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good, thanks.
Good. I've been enjoying the heat. I went to a vintage motorcycle show on Saturday called Rockerbox in Elk Hart Lake. And Sunday I did some ATV racing.
Wow.
With WIXC Cross Country Series.
So the heat is not something that kept you back. In fact,
it sounds like
it enhanced it for you.
Yeah, definitely.
And now your ATV racing, how much do you have to bundle up for that?
try to wear as little as possible in the heat, but...
I mean, shorts, you know, you get some scrapes and bruises there.
We still got to wear long pants, jerseys, helmets, you know, still got to wear all the protective gear, but...
All right, well, more power to you, Greg, for enjoying the hot weather. And that's, I can be kind of wimpy, I'll say, when it comes to the hot weather. And this weekend, I tried to get out. I barbecued last night, which keeps it cooler in the house. Went to a neighborhood festival a couple times. It's by the lake, so there was some breeze there. So I actually managed to get out and enjoy it. How about you?
I basically avoided the heat and stayed in
air conditioning.
Usually
me. I'm not judging you.
Yeah, the kids, though, both my kids got out and they went swimming for the first time.
Good.
So this was good. I mean, it's swimming weather. It's summer. Summer's here, so to me, that's an ideal way to get out there and beat the heat. And music host Stephanie Elkins shared her hot weather hack. She said, I caved and went to the convenience store for Ben and Jerry's chocolate fudge brownie ice cream. Totally rationalized, she says. It melted very quickly because we didn't have air conditioning, but I enjoyed every single spoonful.
Well, how about you? What do you do when the weather turns hot? Do you cower inside or get out and enjoy it as best you can? What do you like to do on a hot weather day, whether it's outside or at the movie theater, which I also did? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Lisa is with us in Monona. Lisa, hi.
Hi.
What's your story, Lisa?
I work construction, so I know all about the heat.
Yeah, so how do you, and I always think when I go by people working in construction on a really hot day, 90 plus, I feel bad for you. First of all, how do you get through it? What are your secrets?
Well, I work on the bridge, so everything on the bridge is like 10 times what it is down below, because there can be days up there where the wind's so windy that your hard hat doesn't stay on, and you come down below and there's no wind at all. But water, you have to drink. I don't care if you're thirsty or not, just keep drinking it and drinking it and drinking it. You sweat. Like, it's the humidity that gets you, not the heat.
And I've heard
I've
heard from construction workers arguments over do you try to get extra salt? Where do you fall on that?
The salt?
Yeah.
No, I don't. Maybe drink one Gatorade a day. That's it. Because the salt dehydrates you, I feel. You know, and there's a lot of salt in Gatorade water. Don't drink pop. Don't drink anything but water. Just keep drinking it and drinking it and drinking it, whether you're thirsty or not.
All right, Lisa. Well, thanks for calling, and good luck, and stay cool when you're out there doing construction on hot days. Taking your calls on your hot weather coping mechanisms. What do you do when the weather gets up over 90? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234.
So we were out and about this weekend in an air-conditioned vehicle, but we did happen to see that the biking leg of Ironman, which was this weekend in Madison.
And triathlon.
A triathlon in this heat. And we actually talked about it. I said, this was my mindset. This is more revealing about me. But I said, why would you do this? I understand you've trained and it's important and you want to complete your task, but it's in the 90s. It looked so hot to me. So I'm curious to know, do you keep up your exercise routine?
Ooh, yeah.
Even in the heat? I can remember back when I was more of a jogger than I am now that I almost passed out sometimes when I went out and tried to be too heroic. But that's just me. What about you? Are you able to beat the heat and exercise? 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
I am very diligent. I ran exactly as many triathlons this weekend as I did the previous weekend and all previous weekends
before
that.
So consistent this one.
Very consistent. Yes. That would be zero if you hadn't put that together. Back to our callers now. Lynn is with us in Bayview at 800-642-1234. Lynn, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah. What's your story? What do you do when it gets hot?
Well, I garden. I mean, I love the heat. And I adore being out in it. But my dog, my Irish Terrier, has a triple coat. So she doesn't like it so much. So she goes to mom with air conditioning, and mom and Ann sit on a sofa in air conditioning and watch TV while I sit out in the sun and garden.
So a trip to grandma's for the dog while you garden.
Right.
But you appreciate, you like the hot weather for gardening.
I do. I just put my sunglasses and my straw hat on, and I wear long sleeves. I'm fine. It's all good. I'm just so happy to be outside in Milwaukee in summer, you know, after being the long winter. I love it.
Wonderful, Lynn. Thanks so much, but keep that dog cool, definitely. Thanks for that call.
Lynn, thanks a lot, and we're going to go next to Shauna joining us from Milwaukee. Shauna, hello.
Hi. Your last caller, I think, was talking about their dog. I was also thinking about my pup. He just turned 2, and he is a very energetic boy. And so even in the heat, we can't not go out. So when it's hot like that, we just make sure that we bring extra water to the dog park. And instead of staying for like a whole hour, we stay for only a half hour.
So you tone down your routine and you add water.
Oh, yeah. Add extra water.
I'm sure your dog appreciates this, that you get out even during the heat.
Yeah, I have to. As busy as I am, we go to the park every about 3 to 4 times a week.
Excellent. Well, Shauna, thanks a lot for that. Yeah, I'm getting the key here that the water, and more water is key for people and dogs.
Well, and Jill from the Larry Mueller Show, she's a producer, has a water-related tip. When I'm outside, she writes, in this heat, I wear a long-sleeve shirt that I've soaked in water and then wrung out. It acts like air conditioning.
That's clever.
Yeah, and then you maybe put it in the freezer for a while. And then you get out, so you're really just nice and maybe that'd
be
a little too
crackly.
Much.
I would try that. I would totally
try that. Yeah,
that's smart. Let's go next to another caller here. Daniel joins us next in Toma. Daniel, hi.
How you doing? Yeah, I ran a 5K for a fundraiser.
Wow.
I mean, it's only 89. It wasn't quite 90, but I'm going to be running this Saturday too.
Okay, so how does that feel?
Afterwards, you get thirsty and had an orange and a bottle of water. But during the race, I don't run at all. I don't. It doesn't bother me. It's just another day.
that's a tough attitude. More power to you. That's great. He's out there running, and lots of other people out there exercising too for Ironman.
Definitely. Thanks for the call, Daniel. Still time for you to share what you do in the warm weather, the hot weather. Do you get out and embrace it and defy it, or do you try to hide out? Maybe that's the time you catch a movie. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Susanna from our fundraising team had a few tips, but here's the one that I thought was really clever. So a lot of folks here at WPR actually do have these really great ideas. She said, for hot nights, sleep with an ice pack under my pillow. When it gets excessively hot, I can put it against my skin. And when I flip the pillow, I get a cold spot. That's
okay.
Genius.
But doesn't it kind of like condensation, and doesn't it kind of sweat? And I don't know.
Well,
like
I mean, if it's that hot, probably you're kind of sweating too. So what's a little ice pack sweat?
That's true. That's true. That's not so bad. Thanks for that, Susanna. And Erica Janik, you know, from Wisconsin Life. You know Erica.
I do.
Yeah, mm-hmm. We've worked with her for a while. She says, coming to work is how I'm escaping the heat. Free AC. There are flaws with counting on Vilas Hall for your temperature needs. We often keep sweaters here at work in the summer because it gets too cold, or sometimes things break and it gets hot enough that our equipment is in danger. And we have fans running here in the studio whenever we're not on the air. So, yeah, you're rolling the dice if you're going to count on WPR work to keep you cool in the summer.
Pretty nice today, though. The temperature in here is not bad.
Yeah, I'm not complaining today, no. And we don't have to. We're not like the construction worker. We're not doing manual labor.
And it's early. I feel like the temperatures now, it's a little early to have temperatures this hot. So I have
that's
a
true.
June
I'm not ready
birthday.
In June. That's
right.
True.
Exactly, in June. And usually I think of June as, you know, kind of upper 70s, the sweet spot where it's just warm enough, but a little cool in the shade. So this is a little toasty for early on in the summer.
Yeah, I don't complain about 90s in August. And so far, and this is unusual for me, I haven't been complaining about it so far in June. So maybe I'm getting more used to the heat. I don't know.
Oh, maybe you're getting more accepting of it.
Piping down about complaining about stuff. Either way, thanks so much for your calls and your comments. You can keep the conversation going. Share your hot weather survival tips on the Central Time Facebook page. Just search for Central Time on WPR over on Facebook.